Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is best-selling writer David Grant of The New Yorker. He's the author of The Killers of the Flower Moon, about the Osage murders in the 1920s, The Lost City of Z, about the disappearance of British explorer Percy Fawcett in the Amazon, and The Old Man and the Gun, about bank robber Boris Tucker. His latest book tells the story of 21st century polar explorer Henry Worsley and its fascination with early polar explorer Ernest Shackleton. Worsley and two colleagues followed in Shackleton's footsteps in an unaided, human-powered 2009 expedition to the South Pole. He returned to retrace Roald Amundsen's trek to the pole in 2012, and in 2015 he attempted to cross Antarctica by himself, with no aid whatsoever, an attempt that would fail and cost Worsley his life. David Grant writes of Worsley's remarkable life in his book, The White Darkness. He'll be talking about his book and signing tonight at 7 o'clock at All Souls Unitarian Church in a Magic City Booksmart Tulsa event. And he joins me today here on Studio Tulsa. David Grant, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
What attracted you to the story of Henry Worsley?
You know, I've always, ever since I was young, been interested in polar explorers. You know, these people who would, in pursuit of some Arctic grail, go to what was, you know, arguably the most brutal environment in the world, where these temperatures would fall into 70 minus degrees Fahrenheit, where winds would gust up to 100, 200 miles per hour, where one misstep, they'd fall into a crevasse. And so when I read that Henry Worsley, a British man, was planning in 2015 to do what his hero, Ernest Shackleton, had failed to do a century earlier, which is to walk from one side of Antarctica to the other, I was immediately drawn to the story. And I think I was drawn to it for a few reasons, not just because of my interest in polar exploration, but also I think it's a story about one of the greatest tests of human endurance that reveals something about the human character. It also contains within it a remarkable love story. And I think it also tells us something about the nature of leadership and the human condition, even if you're like me and you never planned to become a polar explorer.
Well, I was struck by a line in the book. It said, you know, when we think about the polar regions, there's a line that says, you know, who decided that hell was a hot place?
Yes.
Because all you have to do is experience extreme cold and you know that really hell is an extremely cold place.
Yeah.
I forget who said that.
Yeah. You know, who said that is actually Henry Worsley's distant relative, who had been a member of one of Shackleton's most famous expeditions, and they are trapped in this ice. And he said, whoever said hell was a hot place. One of the hardest and greatest challenges of the book was to wrap my mind around Antarctica, because it's less like any place on Earth. I've written about the Amazon for The Lost City Z and spent a lot of time in the Amazon. But even the Amazon you can fathom. I mean, we've seen wildernessy areas. But unless you've grown up somewhere near a polar region, it's more like going to Mars than it is like any place on Earth. It is the coldest continent in the world. It is the windiest continent in the world. It is the continent with the highest elevation. And the thing that struck me most is that it is, first of all, it's about 5.5 million square miles. It's larger than Europe. And then in the winter, the coastal areas freeze over, and so it nearly doubles in size. But the thing that really is the most peculiar thing about it is that it's covered in an ice sheet, which contains about 70% of all the fresh water on Earth. And yet it's classified as a desert, as the driest continent on Earth, because there's so little precipitation.
You mentioned the high altitude. This is something I had not really thought about. I knew that there was a mountain on Antarctica, but we think of the North Polar region, it's right at sea level.
Yes.
These guys are
crossing mountains that are nearly 15,000 feet high, and they have to cross the mountains if they're going to get to the South Pole or to cross the continent. And one of the few paths to get across those mountains is something called the Beardmore Glacier, which is this kind of frozen highway. And it is pock with crevasses, and Henry Worsley referred to it as his nemesis. And on his first expedition, when he was going to try to cross it, at that time only 12 people, the same number that had walked on the moon, had ever traversed the length of the glacier. And some of them, like members of Robert Falcon Scott's famous South Pole expedition, never returned.
You mentioned likening it to Mars or something. In fact, NASA tests their spacesuits
in
Antarctica.
They test their spacesuits. And the other thing is, there's no life in the interior. Around the coastal regions, you know, you'll see penguins and you'll see some animal life. But once you move into Antarctica toward the interior, the only life is some little weird bacteria. Other than that, there is no human life. I mean, it is a place that is inhospitable to human life. And so the fact that people would set out to traverse it and to try to eke out an existence on it is kind of mind-boggling.
There's a line in the book that says Antarctica can take you in two ways, by wearing you down, basically malnourishing you by the expenditure of energy and your inability to basically replenish that energy, or in a second with a crevasse. That was a very telling statement.
Yeah, very much so. And that was Henry Worsley who will just be worn down. Now, one of the things that is so difficult about these expeditions and why they're so exhausting is people like Henry, and who was emulating some of his polar heroes, they can only haul so many supplies on their sleds because they have to pull. But they have to pull all their food, which leaves them vulnerable to starvation. It's not like they can stop or they can hunt or they can find food. So they have to bring all their food with them, which means their sleds or their pulks are extremely heavy. I mean, Henry's sled, when he set out, weighed nearly double his weight. But they have to haul all that with them. So the breakdown, the human exhaustion, where they would walk for sometimes up to 16 hours a day, burning as many as 6,000 to 8,000 calories a day, leads to this kind of exhaustion, to starvation. And then, of course, the other great threat you mentioned is the crevasse. And these are these hidden chasms that are sometimes as will open up and be as wide as a car, and they will swallow you whole.
And there may be snow over it.
Yeah.
And it may be a thin layer of ice or snow, and it's like you step through it and
you're gone. I mean, Henry would take his pole and he would jam it in front of him. And if he saw the ice give way, he would often peer down into this dark, endless chute. One time on one of his expeditions, when he had companions, he began to fall through up to his waist. He was clinging to the edge, and his companion pulled him out. And he said, every time you got out, he said, you felt like your luck was running out.
You know, and the other thing about, there's a beautiful photograph in the book of something called a sastrugi, I guess.
Yes, sastrugi, I call it. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation.
Yeah, sastrugi. But the only thing I can liken it to is thinking of a frozen ocean with the waves freezing in place.
That's exactly what I think that's a beautiful image, because that is really what it looks like. It's these wind-sculpted waves. Again, Antarctica is so darn windy. It is, again, the windiest continent, and, you know, winds have been recorded at 200 miles per hour. You know, you'll have routinely, you know, hurricane force, gale force winds on a regular basis. And so what that does is it blows the ice into these kind of violently shaped waves that will stretch all the way to the horizon, and it looks like a frozen ocean. And those waves do not give way. They are hard. They are pounding hard. And so you have to figure out how to get over them. And that is just one of the many, both majestic and exhausting formations that you would encounter. And you become an expert in the ice because you're spending hours in this kind of deathscape almost, this beautiful, majestic place that is so beautiful and yet at any moment might take your life. But, you know, there's an awesome silence. You're alone and you become an expert in every form of ice. And Henry would, you know, whether it's soft ice or sludgy ice, whether it's the sastrugi, whether it's the blue ice, which is harder than any other ice, you get to know what every surface is like.
We should mention, you talk about him pulling a sled. He was not doing this in a 21st century way. He was going back to the way Shackleton went across. They were hauling sleds, and that's part of this adventure that he embarked on.
Yeah, so Henry would do his expeditions unsupported and unaided, the same way his heroes had. And what that meant is he had to haul all his supplies on his sled. He could not have food caches or food deposits planted along the way to forestall starvation. And he did not have the assistance as he pulled the sled from dogs or kites or other implements that would have facilitated and made it less wearisome.
And this gets back to what drove Worsley. You mentioned briefly that he was a military veteran, a decorated military veteran. Tell us a little about him.
Yeah, Henry Worsley is really one of the most remarkable people I've written about. He is a polymath. He was a decorated Army officer who had served two tours with SAS, which is an elite commando unit akin to our Delta Force. He was a photographer who meticulously documented his expeditions. He was a sculptor. He was an artist. You know, when he served in Afghanistan, he would pause and suddenly bring out his paint kit and brushes and paint the setting. And he would do the same on some of his polar trips. And he was an amateur historian who had become a leading authority on Shackleton and the golden age of polar exploration. He was a devoted family man and father. He had kind of all these pieces to him. In many ways, he seemed like a man out of time.
And he was absolutely fixated on Ernest Shackleton. Some people may know who Ernest Shackleton is. For those who don't, he was a polar explorer. He famously got marooned by sea ice on one of his expeditions, expertly led his men, every one of them, to safety. And we're talking like months and months and months. Yeah. Really amazing man.
Yeah, he was an amazing man. He's really considered one of history's greatest leaders, even though in many ways he was a failure. He failed to reach the South Pole first, which he'd hoped to do, and then he failed to trek across Antarctica, which he hoped to do. That is the most famous of his expeditions, the Endurance Expedition, because that was the name of his ship, the Endurance. They're trying to reach their base camp to set out, and the ship becomes frozen in ice, and they become trapped on this boat, and then the boat sinks, and they are marooned 1,000 miles from the closest inhabited island, and they don't have a radio. They can't signal for help, and he really, through kind of uncanny powers of endurance and uncanny leadership, manages to keep the party united, not fighting, not mutinying, and gets them all back to safety. And Worsley revered him. And in that, he's not alone. I mean, in an age of modern mastery where we try to master bureaucracies, companies, and most of all, master ourselves, Shackleton has been someone who is studied by astronauts, executives, sporting coaches, political strategists. And Worsley was among them. And he felt this special connection to Shackleton as well because one of his ancestors had been a member of that Endurance expedition. Frank Worsley had been a captain of the Endurance. And so he modeled his leadership in the military after Shackleton. And ultimately, he wanted to test his own mettle and see what he too was made of, and decided fairly late in life, at the age of 47, to embark on his first polar expedition.
Shackleton has become a meme for leadership in many ways. I think you're right that he's become an industry for management book writers and self-help writers.
Yes, yeah.
But that's not really what attracted Worsley to him. He modeled his life on his leadership style.
He really did. And, you know, polar expeditions, this is one of the things that interested me in this story. You know, in some ways it's like this other because it's so different from us. And yet part of what makes these expeditions so interesting, what made Shackleton's expedition so interesting, is because of the conditions, they reduce everything to its fundamental essence. And polar expeditions are really this perfect laboratory for human dynamics. Because in that claustrophobic conditions, among that deprivation, people have to figure out how to survive and how to work together. And history is studded with accounts of expeditions backstabbing, I mean, basically turning into Lord of the Flies, even murdering and mutinying. And Shackleton really managed his people and through various techniques, preaching patience and optimism, ignoring hierarchies and status and class and rank. And Worsley really admired that, and he did. He modeled his military command after that, preaching optimism, ignoring hierarchies that separated him from his soldiers that he commanded, and most of all, always espousing the notion that their welfare, their well-being counted more than anything else.
That's the way you'd want in a military leader. Yeah. But I think you spoke to many people who suggested that approach probably hindered his Army career.
Yes, to some extent it did. His father had risen to the highest ranks. I mean, the pinnacle of the British military.
He was a general who was knighted.
He was knighted by the Queen.
Yeah.
And Henry was a revered Army officer, revered for his bravery, revered by other soldiers. But he also wasn't political.
He was honest about Afghanistan.
He was very honest about Afghanistan. He was one of the early people into Afghanistan, one of the first for the British to decide whether troops should come in. And he warned publicly that it was going to stir up a hornet's nest. And at that time, the politicians didn't want that report. And so that really hindered his military career.
My guest today is David Grand, a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of Killers of the Flower Moon, The Lost City of Z, The Old Man and the Gun. Those have all been movies or going to be movies. And his latest book probably will be the same. It's called The White Darkness. It's published by Doubleday. It's the story of Antarctic explorer Henry Worsley. I want to ask about the fixation with the Antarctic, which seemed to take hold of Henry Worsley. I mean, it's not, he went not once, not twice, but three times.
Yes.
Do you understand it?
Yes and no. It's so different from something that I would ever contemplate. And I think even to the people who loved him, there's an inexplicable quality to it. I mean, I'm very close to Henry's family. And, you know, if you ask his wife and you ask his children, you ask his mother, you know, there is that draw, that lure is a little bit inexplicable. But on the other hand, there are clear things that drew him to it. One was this idea of testing your character. I think he also found a certain spirituality. He was not a religious man, but he was a spiritual figure. You know, on these polar expeditions, on his first expedition, he went with two other companions. And, you know, they would hump like mules for about 14, 15, 16 hours a day. They would get into their tent and collapse. And then Henry Worsley would say to his mates, okay, I'm just going to go for a little stroll now, because he wanted to be alone. And his mates, even his mates who loved Antarctica, were like, that's unfathomable that you would go. And so for Henry, there was almost a Buddhist quality. I mean, there was this thing of self-abnegation and that silence. And he would describe the kind of paradox of Antarctica, which is in that immensity, you were acutely aware of yourself. Every breath, every step, every heartbeat. And yet at the same time, you were acutely aware of your insignificance in the universe. And I think that kind of paradox drew him. And then I think for Henry, getting closer to Shackleton, which is what he modeled his expeditions on, and tried to trace and succeed where Shackleton had failed in Antarctica, first to the South Pole and then trying to trek across Antarctica. I think it was a way for him to get closer to himself. He always wanted to kind of figure out who he was, what he too was made of. What kind of leader was he?
I was trying to get a sense of what it would be like to be in Antarctica, because it's not like the North Pole where it's featureless. There are features. There's very little features. There's a mountain range that you're heading towards, or a glacier you're going up. It's a very different experience than any other place in the world, I think.
Oh, yeah. It is completely different. And, you know, one of the things I tried to do in the book was to include all these photographs, because Worsley would meticulously document these expeditions, as did Shackleton. Shackleton brought a professional photographer, and his photographs, which are also in the book, are very famous. I mean, it's you could see that ship frozen in the ice. But I think when you look at those images, you get a sense of just this alien landscape. I mean, you get a sense of its beauty. I mean, it was immensely beautiful. And yet there's a kind of a nothingness and a silence. I think the thing that really gets it to some degree is during Henry Worsley's first expedition to the South Pole, he's got two companions with him, and they're trying to get to the South Pole, and they're tracing the route that Shackleton in his expedition had tried to get to the South Pole. Shackleton got within 97 nautical miles of the pole and then astonishingly decided to turn back, even though he could have reached the pole, but he was worried about the welfare of his men.
Whether
he could get back and the depletion of food. So Worsley's goal on this first expedition was to reach where Shackleton was at the 97-mile mark and then press on to the South Pole. And he's with two other companions who were also descendants of Shackleton's original crew. And so they wanted to then complete the journey and complete what they called unfinished family business. So they've been trekking and they get to this 97-mile mark, this place that Shackleton had gotten to. And it's this place that had kind of filled their minds, their dreams, and almost lured Worsley and his men to their demise. I mean, they're incredibly depleted. They've lost an enormous amount of weight. And Henry, you know, takes out his GPS and he kind of holds it like a teacup till he gets exactly to the spot where Shackleton had reached. And he takes his pole and he slams it into the ground. And he says, right here, this is the spot. And they look around. And what do they see? Nothing. Absolutely just ice. Barren, windswept ice. Their grail, this place that had filled their consciousness, is no more than a geographical data point in this ice scape. And, you know, I think the quote that probably gets to some degree to the psychological mystery of Antarctica was summed up by one of Worsley's companions, who says, "What is Antarctica other than a blank space upon which to impose yourself?"
I was also struck by something. You alluded to this earlier. There's a scene that you describe in the book where, as they're traveling, Will Gow and Henry Adams, his two companions, they come upon this landmark. It's actually an old wind gauge set by the University of Wisconsin, of all places. And he said, I think his companions were recounting this, and they said he seemed filled with disgust that this human object was imposing on his journey, and he didn't feel good about it till it was out of sight.
Yeah. So, I mean, his two companions, Henry Adams and Will Gow, thought, oh, that's kind of unusual. So basically, they're trekking across this ice, and they come across this little, it's kind of like a little metal pole sticking out of the ground. At first, they're like, what is that? Because, you know, there's nothing to see. And then they realize it was this kind of weather gauge that was reading environmental data, and it set out at the University of Wisconsin. And it's both a reminder that, as much as they're recreating an age, that age has changed. I mean, you know, at the South Pole, there is a scientific research base, and there are something like this, that in the middle of this emptiness, somebody could stick a metal pole. That certainly would not have happened in Shackleton's day. But Henry's companions, you know, they're like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then they keep going. And Henry Worsley is just so distressed and bothered by this, that this kind of intrusion, this man-made intrusion, again, to some degree, there is a self-abnegation that he is looking for, a kind of spiritual quality of being apart from society and apart by those intrusions. And this is a kind of intrusion both into the physical landscape, but I would also say the psychological landscape.
I think it goes into a more unhealthy part of his life as he becomes more obsessive about it. He goes back in 2012. He does another expedition, again, following Roald Amundsen's trek to the pole. And then in 2015, he decides to do this solo transnavigation across the Antarctic. What was the reaction to his family going back to the third time to Antarctica?
Yeah. So, I mean, after his first expedition, you know, Henry didn't think he'd ever go back again. It wasn't his plan. But almost gradually, almost inevitably, ineluctably, he is lured back. Shackleton had described in one of his books, you know, as a child, hearing those little voices that lured him into the unknown. And Henry Worsley always heard those little voices. And soon after coming back, hears them again and goes back. He's married to a woman named Joanna. They have a beautiful, loving relationship. And he's got these two wonderful kids, Max and Elisa, who would paint his skis before every expedition with little messages like, you know, push it, fat ass, if I could say that on the radio. And by endurance, we conquer, you know, which was Shackleton's family motto. And, you know, it's interesting, Joanna and Henry in some ways were opposites because, you know, as she told me, you know, I'm a complete pavement girl. You know, she hated the cold and she thought there was no more dreadful place in the world than Antarctica, even after her husband had spoke of all its glories. But Joanna was somebody who always believed, as Thomas Pynchon, the novelist, said, everybody has an Antarctica, some place where they head out to seek and find answers about themselves, about life. And the weirdness and the oddity is that in the case of her husband, that place was Antarctica itself. It wasn't some metaphorical place. It was that place. And so she would give her blessings to these expeditions, even though it threatened to take the life of the man she loved so much.
But a solo circumnavigation, that just seems kind of reckless.
It was undoubtedly dangerous. Shackleton had hoped to traverse the continent on his endurance expedition before his ship got frozen in the ice. It's a journey of about 1,100 miles across the continent from one side to the other, traversing the South Pole. Now, where Shackleton had hoped to do it as part of a larger expedition, Worsley, who was then about 55, he was 55 in 2015, wanted to do it alone, and he wanted to do it unsupported and unaided. And nobody had ever even dared this feat before. I mean, it was Worsley's hardest, his most punishing expedition. And what also set it apart is that he would have to survive entirely on his own wits. He would not have companions to assist him, to eyeball him. In some ways, what made it such a difficult challenge is Henry was a remarkable leader. But in this case, he had to be the leader only of himself. And in some ways, that's harder, because when you're with a group, you have the welfare of your mates in mind. And with yourself, you have only yourself. And it is easier to be reckless in a way. You know, this expedition was unheard of and incredibly difficult.
Give you an idea. He gets to the South Pole. There's a South Pole station. There are people. He trudges right on past.
Yeah.
He says, I'm not going to stop, because this was wouldn't be what Shackleton had done.
Yeah, it's so poignant. I mean, it's unsupported and unaided, which means he can't get any assistance from anyone. So he treks it's 570 nautical miles, which is just, you know, well over 600 miles. They usually calculate nautical miles, yeah, polar explorers. And he gets to the South Pole. And there is a scientific research base. And in fact, people come out to greet him. I mean, he was a revered figure. He was considered and hailed as one of the greatest polar explorers of our time. And yet he can't go inside and get warm. He can't go get a cup of soup or a hot cup of tea. Because of the parameters he has set, he has to continue on. And he sets up his tent not far away from the base in his self-imposed exile.
He continues on past the South Pole. But eventually he does stop the expedition.
He would always ask himself whenever he was in danger, what would Shackleton do? Or as he would say, what would Shacks do? And on this expedition, he gets to a point where his life is in more danger than it's ever been. And he asks himself that question, what would Shacks do? And this time, his life would very much depend on the answer.
And eventually he does end short of the goal, and it cost him his life.
It does. He calls for a rescue plane and is taken off the ice, but he is suffering so much and he has an internal infection that ultimately takes his life.
Hmm. Well, it is an amazing story. And I assume you enjoyed getting to know Henry Worsley. What made him tick? What do you come away from this book with?
Well, he really is one of the most remarkable people I've written about. He was hard as nails, but he also had this artistic temperament. And I think we all in our own life face our Antarcticas, which is we face our human limitations. And we all have to reckon with that. And so for me, one of the more deeper and profound parts of Henry Worsley's story is this is a man who had never failed, had never given up, and has to reckon with that, just the way Shackleton did. And I think we can all draw something from that.
David Grand, thanks very much for joining us. New Yorker staff writer David Grand speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa, speaking about his latest book, The White Darkness. It's published by Doubleday. He'll be talking about his book and signing the book tonight at 7 o'clock at All Souls Unitarian Church in a Magic City BookSmart Tulsa event. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.